Train number 57 was lined along the track, ready to leave for Wyatt Junction when she reached Cheyenne, left her car at the garage where she had rented it, and walked out on the platform of the Taggart station. She had half an hour to wait for the eastbound mainliner to New York. She walked to the end of the platform and leaned wearily against a lamppost. She did not want to be seen and recognized by the station employees. She did not want to talk to anyone. She needed rest. A few people stood in clusters on the half-deserted platform. Animated conversation seemed to be going on, and newspapers were more prominently in evidence than usual. She looked at the lighted windows of train number 57. For a moment's relief in the sight of a victorious achievement. Train number 57 was about to start down the track of the John Galt line, through the towns, through the curves of the mountains, past the green signals where people had stood cheering, and the valleys where rockets had risen to the summer sky. Twisted remnants of leaves now hung on the branches beyond the train's roofline, and the passengers wore furs and mufflers as they climbed aboard. They moved with the casual manner of a daily event, with the security of expecting a performance long since taken for granted. "We've done it," she thought. "This much, at least, is done." It was the chance conversation of two men somewhere behind her that came beating suddenly against her closed attention. "But laws shouldn't be passed that way, so quickly. They're not laws, they're directives." "Then it's illegal." "It's not illegal, because the legislature passed a law last month giving him the power to issue directives." "I don't think directives should be sprung on people that way, out of the blue, like a punch in the nose." "Well, there's no time to palaver when it's a national emergency." "But I don't think it's right, and it doesn't jive. How is Reardon going to do it when it says here?" "Why should you worry about Reardon? He's rich enough. He can find a way to do anything." Then she leaped to the first newsstand in sight and seized a copy of the evening paper. It was on the front page. Wesley Mooch, top coordinator of the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, "in a surprise move," said the paper, "and in the name of the national emergency," had issued a set of directives, which were strung in a column down the page. The railroads of the country were ordered to reduce the maximum speed of all trains to 60 miles per hour, to reduce the maximum length of all trains to 60 cars, and to run the same number of trains in every state of a zone composed of 5 neighboring states, the country being divided into such zones for the purpose. The steel mills of the country were ordered to limit the maximum production of any metal alloy to an amount equal to the production of other metal alloys by other mills placed in the same classification of plant capacity, and to supply a fair share of any metal alloy to all consumers who might desire to obtain it. All the manufacturing establishments of the country, of any size and nature, were forbidden to move from their present locations, except when granted a special permission to do so by the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. To compensate the railroads of the country for the extra costs involved, and to cushion the process of readjustment, a moratorium on payments of interest and principal on all railroad bonds, secured and unsecured, convertible and non-convertible, was declared for a period of 5 years. To provide the funds for the personnel to enforce these directives, a special tax was imposed on the state of Colorado, as the state best able to assist the needier states to bear the brunt of the national emergency. Such tax to consist of 5% of the gross sales of Colorado's industrial concerns. The cry she uttered was one she had never permitted herself before, because she made it her pride always to answer it herself. But she saw a man standing a few steps away. She did not see that he was a ragged bum, and she uttered the cry because it was the plea of reason, and he was a human figure. "What are we going to do?" The bum grinned mirthlessly and shrugged.
"Who is John Galt?"
It was not Taggart Transcontinental that stood as the focus of terror in her mind. It was not the thought of Hank Reardon, tied to a rack, pulled in opposite directions. It was Ellis Wyatt. Wiping out the rest, filling her consciousness, leaving no room for words, no time for wonder, as a glaring answer to the questions she had not begun to ask, stood two pictures. Ellis Wyatt's implacable figure in front of her desk saying, It is now in your power to destroy me. I may have to go, but if I go, I'll make sure that I take all the rest of you along with me. And the circling violence of Ellis Wyatt's body when he flung a glass to shatter against the wall. The only consciousness the pictures left her was the feeling of the approach of some unthinkable disaster, and the feeling that she had to outrun it. She had to reach Ellis Wyatt and stop him. She did not know what it was that she had to prevent. She knew only that she had to stop him. And because, were she lying crushed under the ruins of a building, were she torn by the bomb of an air raid, so long as she was still in existence, she would know that action is man's foremost obligation, regardless of anything he feels. She was able to run down the platform and to see the face of the station master when she found him. She was able to order, "Hold number 57 for me." Then to run to the privacy of a telephone booth in the darkness beyond the end of the platform, and to give the long-distance operator the number of Ellis Wyatt's house. She stood, propped up by the walls of the booth, her eyes closed, and listened to the dead whirl of metal which was the sound of a bell ringing somewhere. It brought no answer. The bell kept coming in sudden spasms, like a drill going through her ear, through her body. She clutched the receiver as if unheeded. It was still a form of contact. She wished the bell were louder. She forgot that the sound she heard was not the one ringing in his house. She did not know that she was screaming, "Ellis, don't, don't," until she heard the cold, reproving voice of the operator say, "Your party does not answer." She sat at the window of a coach of train number 57 and listened to the clicking of the wheels on the rails of Reardon metal. She sat unresisting, swaying with the motion of the train. The black luster of the window hid the countryside she did not want to see. It was her second run on the John Galt line, and she tried not to think of the first. The bondholders, she thought. The bondholders of the John Galt line. It was to her honor that they had entrusted their money, the saving and achievement of years. It was on her ability that they had staked it. It was on her work that they had relied, and on their own. And she had been made to betray them into a looter's trap. There would be no trains, and no lifeblood of freight. The John Galt line had been only a drain pipe that had permitted Jim Taggart to make a deal and to drain their wealth unearned into his pocket, in exchange for letting others drain his railroad. The bonds of the John Galt line, which this morning had been the proud guardians of their owner's security and future, had become in the space of an hour scraps of paper that no one would buy, with no value, no future, no power, save the power to close the doors and stop the wheels of the last hope of the country. And Taggart Transcontinental was not a living plant, fed by blood it had worked to produce, but a cannibal of the moment, devouring the unborn children of greatness. The tax on Colorado, she thought, the tax collected from Ellis Wyatt to pay for the livelihood of those whose job was to tie him and make him unable to live, those who would stand on guard to see that he got no trains, no tank cars, no pipeline of Reardon metal. Ellis Wyatt, stripped of the right of self-defense, left without voice, without weapons, and worse, made to be the tool of his own destruction, the supporter of his own destroyers, the provider of their food and of their weapons. Ellis Wyatt being choked, with his own bright energy turned against him as the noose? Ellis Wyatt, who had wanted to tap an unlimited source of shale oil, and who spoke of a second renaissance? She sat bent over, her head on her arms, slumped at the ledge of the window, while the great curves of the green-blue rail, the mountains, the valleys, the new towns of Colorado went by, in the darkness, unseen. The sudden jolt of brakes on wheels threw her upright. It was an unscheduled stop, and the platform of the small station was crowded with people, all looking off in the same direction. The passengers around her were pressing to the windows, staring. She leaped to her feet, she ran down the aisle, down the steps, into the cold wind sweeping the platform. In the instant before she saw it, and her scream cut the voices of the crowd, she knew that she had known that which she was to see. In a break between mountains, lighting the sky, throwing a glow that swayed on the roofs and walls of the station, The hill of Wyatt Oil was a solid sheet of flame. Later, when they told her that Ellis Wyatt had vanished, leaving nothing behind but a board he had nailed to a post at the foot of the hill, when she looked at his handwriting on the board, she felt as if she had almost known that these would be the words. "I am leaving it as I found it. Take over. It's yours."